So my name is Juan Restrepo. I'm from Oregon State, and I'm going to be talking to you about what I think is a nice little problem. It's a highly non-technical talk, but I also am looking forward to some feedback on it, in which I'll leave room in the end for that. Now I'm going to take a sidetrack. I have to tell you what Sticky Waters is, but before that, let's see if this is going to work. No, these things never work. Okay, so before that, I'll tell you a little bit of background. So through this BP effort, I sort of entrusted myself into creating a new oil fate model. And most of the oil fate models are Lagrangian models. This was to be an Eulerian model. It's still under development. And what I'm trying to do with this model is to use it actually for very large spatial temporal scales, the scales at which environmental questions may be answered rather than those that are of interest to the oil companies, which is for the oil companies, all they care about is the first few days in which an oil spill happens, because that's the only time when you can recover oil that's of any use. After that, you just let the lawyers handle it. And as we have seen, the lawyers, BP, has proven that you can have a major disaster and still survive quite well. Actually, their stocks are doing very well. So I'm looking for something a little different. It's Eulerian.
The fish stocks
are not, but the against the poor fish, you have the bureaus of tourism that do not want to allow this information to get out, which is that things are not looking good, but tourism is still great. Okay, so anyway, what a shallow water oil fate model is one that only captures the oil at the surface and the subsurface. You don't have any details of what happens under the surface. That is not to say that you don't need information, depth information about the ocean dynamics, but the oil is done this way. And the main motivation for this is because this is a very complicated problem. We have to track about 1,000 chemicals, 20 droplet sizes. Yes, you do have to track the dynamics of droplets. And then you have the usual advection, diffusion, and turbulence issues to contend with. The system has to be driven by wind, so you would like to, one reason for coupling, for going the Eulerian route, is to appreciate, to couple to very good models for wind and ocean waves. And if we have the gumption, we're even gonna try to have a chemodynamics component to it, but that hasn't happened yet. Okay, so now why focus on the shallow waters? So the problem that we were working on is, of course, the Gulf Coast. And this essentially is meant to show you where a lot of shallow waters exist. Most of the work done by the BP effort is in the deep waters, by the way. And to convey a sense of how shallow waters are, this is sort of distance in kilometers. This is about 50 kilometers here, and this is some tract actually off of New Orleans, and you see the waters are of depth 20 meters, something like that. And the primary reason why I'm interested in the shallow water is this reason, which is one reason that's pointed out by my brother, who actually works for the oil companies. So you can imagine our Christmas and Thanksgiving discussions. Yes, they are that way. And so what I'm showing you here is coast of New Orleans. So one thing is meant to be conveyed by this image is that it's a very complicated flow, very interesting things happen. I like interesting things, very complicated bathymetry. And you have, this is silt coming into the coast and such. But the key thing is that these are around 20,000 platforms that are actually drilling the oil. This is where the oil is drilled for. So rather than concentrate on the deep waters, I would like to concentrate where these platforms are. Okay. Now, just to convey sort of a degree of complication of what this model will look like, this is, S stands here for the surface layer of oil. And it looks like an advection diffusion equation. Interesting things here. This has the Stokes drift and the currents, and it also has the wind stress here. The wind stress here is proportional to the wind stress. The transport part here is proportional to the to the layer thickness squared. And then you have the usual diffusion, a very complicated diffusion term, and then a whole bunch of terms which usually are called chemistry. And of all these things, the only thing I'm going to pull out is the mass exchange with the deep water or subsurface oil, which has to be actually captured by actually a concentration. So C is concentration, H is the layer depth, and the I actually is associated with each chemical. So there's 10,000 of these equations, see. And then there's 20 or so, for each one of those, there's 20 or so droplet distributions. And so the droplet distribution, actually, the way we handle that is we basically abuse of the adiabatic expansion of the adiabatic conditions. We essentially update droplet dynamics at a fast time scale, and then all the advection and dispersion is on a lateral scale at a slow time. And so this essentially is a very complicated looking equation that essentially captures the distribution evolution in terms of birth and death processes. And
so sorry, your subscript I then is like a droplet size and a chemical?
No, it's just the chemical.
It's just the chemical. So how, sorry, I don't quite understand how the droplet size distribution comes into play. You're conserving droplet size as you would back. I mean, how does that work?
So let's, to give you the answer in the most straightforward way, let's say there's only one chemical component. So you still have to worry about droplet size because of buoyancy issues. So what happens is droplet size that are sufficiently big will actually tend to rise up to the surface. If they're sufficiently small, they stay below. And so that's one reason, even if you have a chemical complex that you can consider homogeneous chemically, you still have to track the droplet distribution to get correctly the fluxes between the subsurface oil and the surface oil. Now, if we add to that the complication of chemicals, which I'd like to defer that for some other time, I'll tell you how we handle that, how the droplets are handled with regard to chemistry as droplet sizes, that there is mixing, yes. Okay, so what I'm going to do is essentially, this is meant to say, okay, it's a very complicated problem, and all I'm going to do to talk about nearshore sticky waters is have a very simple mass exchange term, not this very complicated thing that takes into account wave breaking and buoyancy and so on and so forth. We're actually going to prescribe this mass exchange term, and I'm not even going to focus on how this mass exchange term will affect the outcomes. And I'm going to get rid of all the complications with biodegradation, sources and sinks, photodegradation, and just keep advection and diffusion. So I gave this problem to a person that I was collaborating with, and this person has a depth averaged model called ATSERC. And I said, well, look, let's glob on to this oil transport model and let's do some stuff. And he did, and then he's saying, well, I can't get the oil to get to the shore. And I said, well, that's because you have depth average conditions. So in depth average conditions, the average velocity away from the shore has to be zero because it's zero at the shore. So that's what happens when you work with someone who doesn't pay attention to the physics. And so you say, well, in a case, if you're working with a depth average velocity field, the only way you're going to get oil to the shore is through diffusive processes. It's the only way. Okay, so this is showing you a red tide event off the coast of Florida, a very classic looking picture. And so, of course, this is the red tide. Now, this is meant to convey what nearshore sticky waters is, which you have a buoyant plume, let's say, of algae or oil, and the stuff sort of comes towards the shore, and it starts slowing down, and sometimes parking a little bit beyond the break zone. And so that informally is what we call nearshore sticky waters. At the same time when this was all happening, so Jim had been talking to a guy called Wolanski in Australia, and Wolanski presented him a problem about stickiness in the Great Barrier Reef, stuff collecting like nutrients and fish and so on and so forth, collecting in places in the Great Barrier Reef. And so he was looking for an explanation for these sort of things. So I hijacked the name Sticky Waters and applied it to this thing. And the mechanism that I'm showing you here has nothing, no bearing on the mechanism that might be playing a role in the Great Barrier Reef. Okay, so here's another picture. This is off of my home state. And of course, once you talk about near shore sticky waters, you say everything looks like sticky waters. But if you can, we had a whole picnic here, and this stuff, whatever this is, just probably foam, just stay there happily for 2-3 hours in the same place and didn't dissipate. Well, going camping in Oregon. So this is on a lake. Whoops. This is, I knew this was going to happen. Okay, this is terrible, but it even has sound. So you know if it has sound, it's got to be true. And so this is off a lake, and you see the sort of the gunk, that's buoyant gunk, just parking itself off the lake. And so what I meant to say, you probably have seen things of this sort. Now, to be cynical about it, you can't imagine that there is a single mechanism for all of these things. So the way you should take whatever I say next is as a possible explanation for one of the mechanisms for it. Okay. Okay. So, way at the end, I'm going to tell you exactly what nearshore sticky waters are. What are the quantitative conditions that one expects to see if you have sticky waters? But for now, what we want to do is we want to look at why, under what circumstances, do shore-directed pollutants slow down or possibly park themselves off the coast? And this other problems that we were looking at is how do you model actually beaching pollutants properly? It's a very non-trivial problem. And of course, this has implications on what numerical boundary conditions you apply to codes for ocean transport very close to the shore. Okay, so let's take a look at a very stylized caricature of the problem. So what we're going to have is some currents, and we're only going to focus on the shoreward directed part of the current. The current might be something more complicated, and we have a bottom topography which is at depth h of x, and this is meant to capture the oil or whatever buoyant traces you're worried about. P here is the thickness of the mixing length, and what I want you to take is that this mixing length at some times might be smaller than the total smaller than H, and sometimes actually larger than H. Okay, so that's going to appear prominently in this talk. Now, this is a caricature of what the flow should look like. So you have, say, a flow that is directed in this direction, right? Of course, because the velocity on average has to be zero here, it'll be zero everywhere, and so there's got to be some sort of undertow that is pushing stuff back out. One way you can obtain stuff transporting and hitting the shore is if you can actually, if you can resolve the vertical velocity. Of course, you can have something going to the shore and actually pulling out. That's fine. Okay, now, close to the shore, we're going to assume that there is some source of dissipation, wave breaking, perhaps, and it's rather high. And this has some distance L from the shore. And so if the stuff parks itself, it's coming along ballistically, not feeling much in the way of dissipation. And then something happens in this region which makes it slow down. The key thing is, what we mean by slow down is if you look at the center of gravity of, or center of mass of the stuff, the center of mass is not going to be here at any time, even as t goes to infinity. It's going to be away from the shore. That's what we mean by sticky waters. Okay, so what we're going to do is take this complicated model and just take out little bits and pieces. We're even going to simplify it more, but it basically has advection, diffusion, an exchange term. Like I said, this mass exchange term has to be put in there, but we're not going to focus on that in this talk anyway. And what I'm going to do is kill off all the wind and just simply have a velocity which is going to be perhaps the Stokes drift, is producing the velocity in the shoreward direction. And if you do a depth average, you're going to get something that Jim likes to call the anti-Stokes, which is the stuff that actually counteracts and makes the flow be zero average. Okay. So if you throw everything out, this is a very familiar looking problem. S is the surface slick, and the surface slick is being advected towards the shore by, say, the Stokes drift velocity, but it's just basically the velocity evaluated at the surface. And then you have a velocity in the bulk, which essentially is the velocity in this mixed layer, say. Okay. And then you have to take into account the dispersion. And this dispersion can't be simplistic dispersion. It has to be a little fancier than that. But you can imagine that dispersion is a function of x at the very least, because the dispersion will be very high here and lower in this area. And it has to be non-symmetric. If you get stuff to this point and you let it diffuse, the point is that it has to diffuse asymmetrically, more this way than that way. Okay, but here it should not diffuse at all. Okay, so for the interaction term, we're just simply going to throw in a mass conserving thing that basically says you put in a gamma, and then you put in a tau, which is essentially the time rate at which exchanges happen. We put those in by hand just to, because it's not going to play a role in what I'm going to tell you about. And basically, it just balances out the bulk and the surface oil. Now, this is very important. So S here is measured in length. So it's the thickness of the oil slick. B here is still a concentration, but then what I do is I divide it by the depth, and then I get a concentration. Sorry, I take little b, which is measured in length, and I divide by a depth, and then I get the concentration capital B. But this depth here has to be the minimum of either H or P. So here it might be P, but here it has to be H, right? Okay, so that actually winds up being...
Is it obvious that the dispersion will be the same in both layers?
No, and this we said, let's try the simple... The point here is let's try everything as simple as possible. If we can't get anything out of a very simple model, then it's just basically Occam's razor. Let's try the most obvious things. Okay, so what I'm going to do now... So again, this is in length, and this is a concentration. So now I'm going to write both equations in terms of lengths. And so that's little b and little s. And the reason for doing that is because it makes it obvious how one can get a sticky water situation. So now v here is an effective transport velocity, right? It has the velocity that we know and love, and then it has another term here, right? It's, if you will, if you look at your dispersion, it's going to be the imaginary part, the anti-symmetric part of the stress tensor, right? So that is going to survive, and it gets put into little v. And now you can see that under certain conditions, it might be possible that these two things balance each other out and go to zero. Okay? So that's very important here. So it's just basic kinematics. Okay, so what I'm going to do is sort of paint you a caricature of what the advection velocity might look like and the dispersion, and then we're going to see what happens. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to say, well, why don't we take the Stokes drift as being the velocity, the shoreward component of the Stokes drift as being the velocity that's pushing stuff towards the shore. Now, if you want, you can make it even more complicated and take into account that the Stokes drift velocity actually gets smaller as you get towards the shore because it depends on the water column depth. But hey, let's just take it as being a constant. And then what we'll do is we'll build the eigenfunction corresponding to this bulk velocity as consistent with the kinematics. So it has to be equal to u Stokes at the surface. It has to go to zero at the bottom of the water column. And so it might look like this parabola so that when you depth average the velocity, you get zero. Okay. Now, what about the diffusivity? So, unlike most cases in which we actually put a lot of emphasis on the vertical diffusivity, the thing that is a modeling choice here is to say, no, well, we have to take into account the transverse diffusivity, eddy, if you will, eddy viscosity. And so you'll have that d of x has both of these components, and so we're talking about these transverse rather than the vertical viscosity. You can throw in the vertical viscosity, but it plays much more a role. So these numbers here are inspired by reasonable choices for a tub that is 1,000 meters long and maybe 20 meters deep, and at the shore is about 1 meter deep, and is just sloped. And so what we have here essentially is a dispersion or diffusivity that's very high close to the shore. And like I said, it has to be non-symmetric, because if stuff gets to this point, you want it to diffuse in a very non-symmetric way. And that's reasonable to assume that the cause of this high dispersion close to the shore might be just wave breaking and mixing. Okay. So now let's play around with this V, right? This is the effective velocity of transport of the bulk of the oil. And what I'm plotting here is, what I'm doing is I'm taking the mixed layer and make it bigger and bigger compared to the slope of the bottom. So where is the, I want to get the numbers. Okay, so let's, I should have shown you this first. So we're going to take the deep end here to be 20 meters deep, and the shallow end to be 1.2 meters deep. The length is going to be 1,000 meters, okay? So remember those numbers. And P, remember, is the effective thickness of the mixed layer. And what I'm doing is I'm showing you what V of X looks like for a simple sloping bottom. When I just simply change how much of the water column is taken up by the mixed layer. And as you can see, when P equals 1, this curve here, so P equals 1, the mixed layer is always smaller than the water column depth, always. And so this velocity is never zero, okay? Now, if you make the mixed layer thicker and thicker, what happens is there is a place at which this velocity actually goes to zero. Simple as that. So if the mixed layer is very large compared with the local depth, this effective velocity has to go to zero. Okay? And this is on the crudest assumptions on with regard to the bottom topography and the dispersion. Okay, so now what I'm going to do is just show you pictures of what you get of result. I like my Gaussians. So what we're going to do is we're going to put a Gaussian off of 500 meters out here. We're going to put a Gaussian. We're going to put all the oil in the slick, and we're going to let the system evolve. So it's being pushed by a prescribed velocity, Stokes drift. I think it was in the order of 5 centimeters per second, something like that. And we can revisit the dispersion, but the dissipation is very high at the shore, but reasonable and lower elsewhere. So P equals 1, we expect no stickiness. So this is space. So here's our initial blob, and this is the shore. And so what we have is, this is the slick, right? Not the bulk, but the slick oil. And so the slick is losing oil to the bulk, but essentially everything gets to the shore. So if we wait long enough, all the stuff makes it to the shore, okay? So P equals 1 is always smaller than h of x. All right, so what happens if we make P larger? So P equals 3 means that the mixed layer and the depth are about equal, about 94 meters away from the shore. That's within the diffusion zone. And so what you have is you have ballistic propagation, but there is some slowing down, right? And it looks like the center mass of this stuff is away from the shore. All right, and P equals 6 puts this, the place where the bulk velocity, the effective velocity goes to zero at 210 meters away from the shore. And there you definitely have stickiness if you compute the center mass for this flow for all times. greater than this transient, you'll find that the center mass is away from the shore. And so that's what we mean by stickiness. And nothing terribly complicated going on here. Now, so Carter, at the same time, Carter Ullman, he's here. Actually, he's physically here. And his collaborators were also at those, at about the same time looking at what they're doing is they're field folks, and they go and measure things and so on and so forth. And they were looking at transport velocities using both numerical means as well as instruments. And they were also noticing that the velocity of transport also got smaller as you get closer and closer to the shore. And so these are actually plots that actually Carter, I hope, will discuss later on. So I'm just simply going to say a little bit about them. But so this is supposed to be the topography for Santa Barbara, and this is Huntington Beach, right? And so this is far from the shore. This is close. This is 20-meter depth. And the actual topography is this one. And so what they get here is a slowing down of the velocity. But notice here, the velocity here is slowing down, but it's non-zero, right? So this slowing down is not going to produce stickiness because it's still non-zero, right? Now, why is this non-zero and the other velocity is zero? It's because this is not the velocity for the transport of all of the oil. This is the velocity for, say, the surface spill, but not for all of the oil. Okay? Okay, so now why don't we get some estimates as to see how this thing works? So what I did is, of course, the reason for using a Gaussian bump is that I can actually write down a Fokker-Planck equation associated with this problem. So Q here is some proxy of the amount of oil in the layer. And then this is my Fokker-Planck equation. And then I can look, actually I can solve for Q, that effective oil, this is abstraction of oil, as a function of time and space. And so if you look at the steady state of this equation, trivially, it looks like the familiar, it looks like a familiar expression to you. So this is Q infinity. This is the steady state solution to this Fokker-Planck equation. And it's got the right things in the right places. And so now you say, well, okay, so now I know what the steady state is. What about the time-dependent part? So you just simply put an ansatz of this form, and then you get an eigenvalue problem out of the Fokker-Planck equation, and then with a little bit of trial and error, you can just get the expression, the analytic expression for the solution to this thing. So now you got an abstraction that gives you analytically what the solution should look like. And so we're going to use that abstraction to calculate, so it's an effective oil. Q is not S or is B, but this is what Q and B look like under P equals 1, 3, and 6. So remember, 1 means that the layer, mixed layer, is always smaller than the water column depth. 3 matches over here, and 6 over here. 3 is inside the messy place, and 6 is outside. And so now what we're looking at is a long-time solution of S and B. So if we wait long enough, we see that the center mass, this is the shore, this is the deep part, and we see that the oil that started in the slick goes into the bulk, but all of the oil gets to the shore. So it starts like this, and then and that's the exchange term. And that is not surprising, we put that in by hand, at least in this particular presentation. We have another one in which we show what happens if you do this more carefully. P equals 3, now you have the slick actually makes it to the shore, but the bulk, the center mass of the bulk is away from the shore. And in this case, you clearly have a sticky water situation. So what you get out of this thing from an operational standpoint is something that is opposite from the way people respond to oil spills, let's say in New Orleans. So what they do is they try to make the near shore as calm as possible. So what this is telling you is that you don't want to do that. You want to make it as choppy as possible so that the stuff actually collects away from the shore rather than get to the shore. Okay. So what I'm now showing you, this is a complicated plot. I was going to clean it up. I didn't have time. I forgot. So what I'm showing you here is the...
Yeah. Why do they make it as common as possible? Is it for collection?
Yeah, so they think, well, let's make it as calm as possible. They're going to use floaters essentially to skim.
Skim, okay.
Yeah, and so let's calm it down. And so this is saying, well, first skimming is hopeless. Forget about that. But just make it as choppy as possible. At least you won't get it on the shore. Right, so it's opposite from what you... It's what a kid would do, but not what an engineer would do, right? So a kid would start splashing like crazy because of panic. The engineer says, oh, I think I know something, and then the stuff goes on the shore. Okay, so this is meant to convey the ballistic track, right? So this is the space-time plot with some prescribed Stokes drift velocity. So this is called the ballistic plot, and this is for p equals one case, and there's a lot of things going on here. This is meant to compare this reduced model to the full ODE solution, and what is conveyed with all these plots is that it works out just great. But essentially you have here, this one is the one to focus on. So this is the oil approaching the shore as a function of time, and then at a certain point it makes it to shore and then stays on the shore. There is a little bit of a slowdown here. When p equals 3, then there is a significant slowdown, so this would be the ballistic speed. This says that for p equals 3, you're given sort of a couple of hours reprieve before you have to go get in the car and panic. But some of the oil will make it. Mostly what's going to make it is the slick, but the bulk will not make it. So it's all going to be on the surface where you can skim it. And then finally, in this case, p equals 6, it says most of the oil actually is going to be in the bulk, very little in the slick. And as you can see, the center of mass is going to be clearly away from the shore. And this is the ballistic path. So there's a slowing down and perhaps even accumulation. This case corresponds to this case. Okay, so basically, we have from this little exercise two quantities that we can use to sort of predict what range, two quantities that give you something about the range of outcomes. So beta is sort of a normalized version of P versus H. And so when beta is equal to small, then P is always smaller than the water column depth. And so for beta less than zero, you have no sticky conditions. And then where beta is very large, you have the possibility of a sticky situation outside of the break zone. And between 0 and 1, you have a break zone sticky water situation, but one in which there's a very complicated exchange between slick and bulk oil. And then I didn't talk about the interaction term. That winds up being a fascinating and very complicated problem. That's where all the multi-scale issues come in, and then you have to track droplets and so on and so forth. And that gives you a whole other story for another talk, so I'm not going to talk about it. But essentially, it says that decreasing the rate at which you prescribe how the exchanges occur between the slick and the bulk, that decreasing gamma leads to more stickiness. And so what do we plan for the future? Well, we are encouraged, and so now we want to try something more realistic. I've been talking to Tom Peacock to see if he can actually produce some experiments in his lab at MIT. If he has some time, he's going to try it. And I'm trying to convince some of the folks here, perhaps, that maybe we can do some field experiments. Now, the key thing here, the point of discussion here, is there an expectation or is an idea as to how to sort of get a signature of this phenomenon, given that you have all sorts of flotsam and jetsam collecting at the shore? What is the key signature to actually go measure or look for to say, okay, this clearly does exist? And so we'd like you to discuss that. And then there are extensions that model biochemical processes, biogeochemical processes, because now in this Trump era, where making oil spills is good, but maybe biology still has a chance, then the idea is to say, well, let's look at organisms being affected by these flows and look at how stuff collects in certain places and how that actually affects populations of fish, and so on and so forth. Now, the one thing this doesn't apply to is the flotsam and jetsam, the crap that actually comes in as well, right? So, so what to do about that case? So this case, my humble observations are that when you see trees and junk and all this stuff piling up on the shore, it's really due to a transient situation. So you have a wave set up and a wave set down that actually is forced into the system. There is a transient situation in which stuff that is going like this all of a sudden goes high enough to get anchored by the shore and stay there. So I think none of this applies to the flotsam and jetsam situation, but I have some ideas as to how to do this problem, and I'm interested in doing that. Here you have to take into account inertial effects of all the junk, as well as all sorts of problems with mechanics of locking and dislodging of stuff. But I think this is an interesting problem to consider as well. And that's it. Thank you. Yeah, so, sorry, question.
Am I correct in perceiving that only it is the Stokes drift, but it is the wave roll in this model?
No, so.
Any chance to include things like collision stress and braking within the braking zone and so on?
Yeah, so as the American philosopher Big Lebowski says, man, it's complicated. So the more realistic model will give a better picture as to what happened. In the near shore, seldom do you have stuff coming straight to the shore, right? You have waves that are coming at an angle. These things actually produce a residual flow that we call the longshore current. And so it's the thing that you park yourself on the beach, you put your stuff on the beach, and you go into the shore, and all of a sudden you wind up down on the shore. That's the thing that's carrying you down. That's the longshore current. It's a very strong current. What we're talking about is the velocity. That part, of course, contributes to what's going on, but that takes stuff away in the lateral direction. All I want to know is I just want the shoreward connected velocity component, and I want to look at the dynamics of that. Clearly, it has something to do with all the other dimensions, but if it is non-zero and it's moving stuff towards the shore, I want to know how the dynamics work.
What about rip currents, which do take things off?
Sure. Right. So that's in the more realistic model. The presumption here is if you have a situation like that, you might have rip currents between the rips, but certainly not all over the coast, right? So, rips would be a form that would definitely destroy the possibility of stickiness occurring, right? Now, the signature for rips is very clear, so that one is easy to pin down. So again, all it is something that some of you are focused on, which is the tensor. The key thing to do it in a sort of adult way is to look at this thing very carefully to see how much of the symmetric and anti-symmetric part in a realistic situation. What is the expression for that thing is an interesting thing in itself, right? Because this balance is key to whether stickiness occurs. And that's something that some of you have been working on, for example, Baylor has. So that in itself, it would be an interesting theoretical. You can put more stuff. You can put in mixing and so on and so forth into this and play these games. But if I didn't get it with a very simple model, then there was no hope in pursuing this anymore. Other questions?
So how much of a ecological issue is the bulk stuff that's just sticking to the bottom offshore? I mean, like another part of the question is okay, if you coat the whole near shore, not on the beach where you don't get newspaper photos, but maybe to say that it's sticky and therefore not a problem is only one problem that's not a problem, but actually coating the seafloor 100 meters offshore might be terrible for other reasons, by especially the seagrasses and things.
Correct. Yeah. A less complicated issue is to say, okay, well, what happens if we just simply throw in bottom drag into this whole mix? And so now you have, you have the possibility of shearing close to the bottom. How is all this happening? That would be the zeroth order problem that I would like to sort of sort out and say, okay, under certain rough conditions, does the whole stickiness get enhanced or completely decreased? And then I would consider, once I have an understanding of how that works, just simply purely kinematics, if you will, then I could say something about that, but I have no idea. Yeah. Now, the thing with bottom drags, of course, is it is a small boundary layer. It doesn't grow forever and ever in the sense that, it's a sort of an oscillatory situation, so it gets big and slow, big and slow. But there are cases, of course, where this bottom drag actually dominates a lot of the profile, the velocity profile. So, complicated. Yeah?
In the Gulf of Mexico, in the BP spill, the depth of the mixed layer vary a lot with time, depending on wind shear or whatever?
I don't know. Do you know, Jim? Do you know, Bill? Yeah. Taylor? I don't know.
We space the stratified region, so it isn't extreme, but definitely calm periods and windy periods.
Cold air outbreaks, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, now that would be, it's not a near shore spill in the sense that the water there was about 100, how deep was this? It was hundreds of meters. Yeah, hundreds of meters or something like that. That made actually the difficulty. Okay, so, but the stuff eventually would get to the shore. Now, the thing is, as my brother told me, he said, well, look, you guys are getting it wrong. What we want to do is we want to take as much dispersant as possible and inject it at depth so that there is no pictures of the surface. That's what they want to do. And that's what they did, right? So in addition to having uncertainties as to how much was ejected by this, although the uncertainty on these estimates is not that bad, the big uncertainty is this humongous injection of dispersants that was done at depth and how that actually plays out. And the other problem is just simply, how do you measure this stuff? So on one hand, there are very nice ways of measuring the presence of oil. So if you go to these talks and these biologists are talking about little bacteria having, 300 million years age, and they're like, okay, I see, they're consuming the oil, and now the bacteria that was 20 minutes of age now is 300 millions. So that's a really strong signal, but so even visualizing where the oil is, what's on the surface and what's at depth, is very non-trivial, very complicated. My feeling on that was that if we get close to the shore, if we can provide to someone where the oil is going and how much, we are making huge progress. If you're close to the shore, I don't think the details of how much oil is on the bottom and how much on the surface matter as much as how much oil there is, period. And so by depth averaging, I'm hoping that one can constrain the system more so that I know how much is on the surface, therefore I can tell how much is at depth. Right? So I think as a zeroth order prediction, I think that would be more valuable than having predictions that tell you what possibly can be happening at depth, because it's incredibly difficult to measure. Yeah, and so the thing that, so there might be many ways of producing this, right? Okay, I hope it doesn't. I'm done with the sound. I should put Hawaii 5-0 on this. Where the hell is it? Yeah, so what would be the signature to look for in this? I have a much, much longer version of this. I just couldn't find it for this presentation. My family was testing their patients, just filming this thing for about half an hour, and it just stayed there, right? And then eventually it'll disappear, but my feeling is that is easily done by a transient change in the flow. Yeah, so I'm not sure what signature to look for. And then going back to Carter's flows, so the drift velocity is still non-zero, right? Very close to the shore. So presumably it still can flux stuff closer to the shore, right? This thing, it says, no, the bulk velocity, effective velocity goes to zero.
That has a rather sharp front compared to sort of your smooth distributions.
Yeah.
So is there some additional physics needed for that? Or?
I think that part is, that part can be explained through just simply Lagrangian parcels. I mean, you essentially, this is an oscillatory flow after all. The velocity is not the same on this side and this side, right? It's, this thing is pitched, right? So you can expect that the residual flow due to Lagrangian paths will not be translationally symmetric, right? Because there is a breaking of the symmetry. So that alone in its, can do this sort of thing. And I've actually had done some trivial calculations where I convinced myself that that is entirely possible. This stuff just simply lumps up if you have a slope, a sloping bottom. And you can use linear weights for that. Well, I guess that's it.